This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zach McCulley, and today I'm joined by Professor John Coffey, who is Professor of Early Modern History at the University of Leicester. John is an accomplished historian who's published widely on Protestant history, and he's the editor of Volume 1 of the Oxford History of Protestant Dissenting Traditions, the Post-Reformation Era, 1559 to 1689. It was published last summer in 2020. And this is the book that we're going to discuss here today. John, congratulations on the book and thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Zach. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you here. And as I mentioned beforehand, now I've just appreciated and benefited from your work for some time. And this book is really no exception to that. But before we get into the book, can you tell our listeners a little more about yourself?
Sure, yeah. You probably can't tell from my accent, but I was actually born in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, to be more precise, right at the start of what are known as the Troubles, the armed conflict in Northern Ireland from the late 60s through to the 90s. But then I moved to England, the north of England, when I was about seven. And it's probably not irrelevant that my father was a Presbyterian minister who then became a Baptist. And that's why we moved over to England to a different church. So I grew up in nonconformist churches. So that's my sort of backstory. Perhaps explains the Northern Ireland background, why I'm interested in religious conflict and toleration. But it also means, I suppose, I have something of an insider perspective on nonconformist history. Though it's interesting, I think, looking at this volume and looking more generally at the people who write about dissent and about religious history in the early modern period, how diverse they are, really. And I'm quite interested in what's sometimes called the insider-outsider problem or dynamic. You know, so some historians write about a tradition they're quite familiar with personally, Anglicans writing about Anglicanism, nonconformists about nonconformity, Catholics about Catholicism. But plenty of other people write from sort of outside those traditions about them. And I tend to think it's quite healthy that you have both insiders and outsiders writing about religious traditions, because religious communities need to reckon with their own history, but equally religious history is too important, if you like, to be left to insiders. It's of wider interest in understanding the past and the present. So you asked about my work and what I've done to date. So I studied at Cambridge University. That's where I did my PhD, and then I've taught for 20 years at the University of Leicester. And Leicester in the 19th century was actually one of the great centres of English nonconformity. Lots of Baptists and Congregationalists and Quakers and Methodists. And my own work has really focused on various aspects of Anglophone Protestant culture, you know, from hymnody to political thought. And I've ranged fairly widely, really, from the late 16th to the 19th century. though until recently I was mainly focused on the 17th century. So I did my PhD on the Scottish Covenanter, Samuel Rutherford, who wrote works of political theory, but also devotional works and works of theology. I wrote a book on persecution and toleration in Protestant England, which covers the same sort of span as this book, from the Act of Uniformity in 1559 to the Act of Toleration in 1689. And then I've written quite a lot around the English Revolution, a book on John Goodwin, who was one of the few clergymen to defend the regicide of Charles I, and then John Milton, the poet. And I've also written a sort of on a broader period in a book on Exodus, Exodus and Liberation, which was about the sort of political use of the Exodus story from the Reformation, really, right through to the civil rights movement. But the most recent project I've finished is a team project led by Professor Neil Keeble, which was to produce a major edition with Oxford University Press of the memoir of Richard Baxter. He's one of the leading dissenting clergy of the 17th century, the Reliquiae Baxterianae, and that came out in 2020 during lockdown, so we had to sort of celebrate on Zoom. But that's the most recent project that I've finished.
Well, you've certainly contributed quite a bit to the scholarship on Protestant dissent. And here there's a really impressive list of contributors also in this volume. Can you talk to us about what led to the editing of this volume and what was the push to have this book written?
Yeah, so about a decade or so ago, I co-edited with my friend Paul Lim, Vanderbilt, the Cambridge Companion to Puritanism. So this is not a dissimilar project, but I was invited by Tim Larson and Mark Knoll, who were the general editors of this Oxford History of Protestant Dissenting Traditions, to edit the first volume on the post-Reformation era. And they were, in a sense, responding to the Oxford History of Anglicanism, which was also coming out, edited by Rowan Strong. And both of these series are five volumes each. They both start with a volume on the post-Reformation era, then they have a volume on the long 18th century, then a volume on the 19th century, then a couple of volumes about modern Anglicanism, modern dissenting traditions, and the globalization of them. So I was attracted by the bigger project, and also by the prospect of drawing together a sort of team of leading scholars to write, I suppose, an up-to-date account of post-Reformation Protestant dissent.
Well, the history of Protestant dissent, it is a complicated one. For example, disputed origins of dissent on terminology, several turning points along the rise of dissent. Maybe it would be helpful to have you kind of lay out for us what Protestant dissent in the post-Reformation era is and how scholars have sought to understand it.
Yeah, that's a great question, Isaac. So I guess dissent assumes or implies establishment, you know, that there's dissent against an establishment. In the case of church histories, one's thinking of an established church. Dissent in England was sort of a legal category, you know, those who refuse to conform to the Acts of Uniformity. So in Protestant England, there were a number of these Acts of Uniformity under Edward VI and then Elizabeth I in 1559. And then at the restoration of the monarchy in 1662, and they required everyone to worship by the book, you know, to worship in the parish church according to the Book of Common Prayer, the common liturgy of the English people. So they assumed that the entire population would be gathered into one national church. So Protestant dissenters are those who, against the law, legally, broke away from the Protestant National Church. And that, if you like, is dissent with a capital D. Though I suppose we could also think of dissent with a small d, internal dissent within the church. So many of those people who eventually break away from the Church of England or set up separate churches are initially small d dissenters within the established church. In terms of its rise, in the early years of Elizabeth's reign, there were very few separatists. There were very few Protestants who'd broken away from the national church. There was a much more substantial number of Catholic recusants, but Protestant dissenters were few in number. And that only really changes in the middle decades of the 17th century. And it's partly in response to two great attempts to transform the national church. First of all, Charles I, an Archbishop Laud, try and pull the church in a high church direction, emphasizing priestly authority and ceremony and the beauty of holiness and kneeling at communion and clerical vestments and so on. And this provokes a great backlash, initially actually in Scotland, where there's a prayer book rebellion, which then leads on to the birth of a Covenanter movement, to bishops' wars, then the recall of Parliament in England, and the outbreak of civil war in 1642 between Parliament and King. And it's in that political context, that upheaval, that Puritans, those who are trying to purify the Church of England, make it more like the continental Calvinist churches, they really undertake a second great attempt at reforming the English church. And that's where the groups that we think of as Protestant descent really become very well established. I mean, they have progenitors in the Elizabethan and early Stuart period, but it's really in the 1640s and 50s during the English Revolution that groups like the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists and the Baptists and the Quakers become established. And although they're severely persecuted during the Restoration, especially Quakers and Baptists, they survive, they even thrive. And in 1689, at the glorious revolution, the revolution of William III, the Act of Toleration grants official toleration to those particular groups. So that by the early 18th century, something like 6% or more of the English population are meeting in these breakaway Protestant denominations. There are about 2,000 meeting houses. The largest group would be Presbyterians. Then there's the Congregationalists, the Baptists, the Quakers. So that's a brief story of the rise of dissent. I guess one of the things we're trying to do in this book, and one of the things that the contributors to the Oxford History of Anglicanism tried to do as well, is complicate things by emphasizing that it's not a simple story of two clear sides, you know, a sort of establishment Anglicanism versus an insurgent Puritan dissent, but that actually that there are various attempts to overhaul the church by both Anglicans and Puritans. And historians have become more skeptical, really, about the dichotomy between Anglican and Puritan and the polarity between establishment and dissent, because groups like the Presbyterians in the 1640s were really the establishment. I mean, they were trying to reform the church. The Congregationalists close to Oliver Cromwell in the 1650s were also part of the religious establishment. They were setting the tune for the Cromwellian church. I mean, even the Quakers, in a sense, become a sort of cultural establishment in Pennsylvania. And of course, the Episcopalians, who eventually come out on top in England, are dissenters in Cromwellian England in the 1650s. And in Scotland after 1689, they're also a minority group who are lobbying for toleration. So there's a sense in which establishment and dissent are not two fixed sides or parties. There's quite a lot of shifting between them over the course of the 17th century. And that's one of the things that this volume and the Oxford History of Anglicanism, I think, are trying to capture, some of the contingency of Anglicanism and dissent.
Well, that's really helpful. And it does kind of situate this volume and what some of the ideas are around the history of Protestant dissent in this period, and maybe where this new volume sort of fits in. It's an impressive volume, as I've mentioned. It contains 21 chapters across four different sections here. Can you comment on the narrative structure of the book and how these four groupings headline the book?
Yeah, sure. The structure is basically the same for each of the five volumes in the series. So I inherited, if you like, the structure. So it begins with part one, which are traditions within England. Then it moves beyond England to thinking of traditions outside or beyond England. And then we've got more thematic chapters around dissent in the world, and then in part four, congregations and living or dissenting life. So part one deals with those major dissenting traditions that emerge from 17th century England and Scotland that I just mentioned, the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, the Baptists and the Quakers. Part two takes us outside England to look at Scotland and Ireland and Wales, which, of course, have their own very distinct stories, as well as looking at English migration into the Dutch Republic, New England, and colonial Quakerism, which looks quite different depending on whether you're looking at New England or the Middle Colonies or the Caribbean. And then in the Dissent in the World section, we've got chapters really on how dissent is related to the parishes, how they related to the state and how the state related to dissenters. We've got a chapter by Bernard Capp on the dissent of the Puritan sort of attempt to reform the English nation in the 1640s and 50s, and a chapter on print culture as well. And then in the final section, we have chapters on the Bible and theology, worship and sacraments, sermons and preaching, women and gender and dissenting laity. So there are about 500 pages altogether, so it's quite a meaty volume. And what we're trying to do is present a rounded account of Protestant dissent, you know, one that is not just Anglo-centric, but takes into account other parts of the Atlantic world, and one that's not just focused on one denomination, but on more widely, but also thinks about the laity and not just the clergy as well, and the wider context of dissent. And I guess the other thing we're trying to do is, if you like, present an up-to-date account. So many people will know a book by Michael Watt, and Michael Watt's The Dissenters, which was published back in 1978. And it takes a story of Protestant dissent in England and Wales from the Reformation to the French Revolution. But obviously a lot of historiographical water has passed under the bridge in the 40 years since that book was published. So we're trying to bring to light the scholarship really of the last generation or so to tell a more sort of up-to-date story about the history of Protestant dissent in the post-Reformation era.
So we have these four sections of the book, and after six chapters dealing with the traditions in England, as you mentioned, we come to those outside of England. And here we've already begun to see some of the fluidity and religious identity within England, and the boundaries of dissent and establishment are really at some points just as fuzzy beyond England. And that could even be true in the case of colonial life in New England. Can you talk to us some about this chapter here on New England?
Yeah, so the chapter on dissent in New England is written by Francis Bremer, who, of course, has written across his career, really, on Puritan New England and its relations with England. And I guess Puritan New England has something of a fearsome reputation, you know, partly we think of Nathaniel Hawthorne and the Scarlet Letter, or Arthur Miller's The Crucible, and witch hunts and the trial of Anne Hutchinson and so on. So it has a bit of a Republic of Gilead feel, you know, in the popular memory. That's not wholly unwarranted. I mean, actually, it's interesting that in Massachusetts is one of the only places to execute Quakers. So there are about five Quakers executed in Massachusetts between 1659 and 1651, not for heresy, but for breaching a banishment order and returning and proselytizing. But, you know, Quakers are imprisoned and subject to corporal punishment in England, but they're not actually executed. And ironically, it's Charles II who puts a stop to that. But New England seems like, I guess, a classic case of dissenters who go abroad, fleeing the Laudian persecution of the 1630s, but then become persecutors themselves. But I think what's interesting about Frank Bremer's chapter is that he adds a lot of nuance. You know, he emphasizes that there was actually quite a lot of room for diversity within the Massachusetts Bay congregations. There's actually quite a lot of theological discussion and dissent, which is tolerated. There's also quite a lot of difference between different colonies. So Massachusetts has a law of banishment against the Baptists, and it executes Quakers. But that's not true of Connecticut or of New Hampshire or of Plymouth. So there's a fair bit of internal variation there. And Massachusetts dissenters are often generated from within as well. You know, this is a sort of family quarrel. People like Roger Williams or Anne Hutchinson or Henry Dunster, who's the president of Harvard, who resigns because he's adopted Baptist views. These are figures really who emerge absolutely out of New England congregational life. And he also points out that there are complicated attitudes among the New England elite towards these new religious sects and movements. So John Winthrop, who's the one of the founders of Massachusetts Bay, his son, John Winthrop Jr., is actually quite a radical figure, quite sympathetic to religious toleration and the Baptists. And another son, Samuel Winship, converts to Quakerism in the 1660s and becomes a Quaker leader in the West Indies, but still maintains quite good relations with New England. So the picture is complicated, even before we've added in Rhode Island, which Roger Williams establishes and which, of course, becomes a haven for various persecuted groups like antinomians or Baptists or Quakers.
Yeah, well, it is a really fine chapter that Frank Brimmer contributes here. Another one I wanted to bring up in our talk here was one by Jacqueline Rose on Dissent in the State. And here she makes some interesting arguments about this paradoxical relationship between the government and dissent, you know, talking about dissent as this legal category. Could you share a bit about what this essay means for the book?
Yeah, so I think it is picking up themes that sort of run right through the book, really, and articulating them very clearly. You know, later dissenters tended to look back at their forebears and emphasize the way they were persecuted and martyred. But recent historiography, as I've explained, complicates the picture because it emphasizes that dissenters were serious contenders at points for control of the establishment, certainly in the middle of the 17th century. And as Jacqueline Rose points out, they weren't always very sympathetic to religious toleration either. I mean, certainly the Presbyterians in the 1640s were highly critical of it, and Congregationalists would have believed in severe limits on religious toleration. Her chapter, I think, as well picks up on the shifts in terms of the historiography of toleration. So an older Whiggish picture emphasizes a fairly linear story, a progression from sort of medieval persecution to Enlightenment toleration, based around heroic intellectuals who set out ideas of religious and intellectual freedom. But revisionist historians have tended to complicate that. You know, they've emphasized that pre-Enlightenment societies often combined coercion with coexistence, with accommodation. So even if you think of Restoration England, Quakers are being persecuted, but you can also find on the ground Quakers serving in civil roles in parishes. So there's a fair amount of everyday ecumenism, as it's sometimes been called, of toleration on the ground. And historians of toleration have been very interested in that across Europe, really, in the last generation. So they've emphasized that pre-Enlightenment Europe isn't just, you know, awash with blood and persecution, but there are all kinds of interesting experiments and coexistence. I mean, another example from the Restoration, I guess, would be the Baptist merchant William Kiffin. You know, he's one of the leading Baptists of the period, but he's also one of the wealthiest merchants in London. And, you know, he has access to the London elite and even at times to court. I think she's trying to present a more nuanced view there of how things were in the 17th century, and equally reminding us that advocates of religious toleration, like John Locke, who was an Anglican but very sympathetic to the plight of dissent, that Locke is, famously limits toleration to Protestants and excludes Roman Catholics and atheists. In his letter concerning toleration. And that's fairly typical of many advocates of toleration in you know, the 17th century and the early 18th century as well. So I think the picture she presents is one that is more complicated than both the older dissenting historiography, which tells us sort of story, a kind of martyrology, and it's more complicated than the older Whig history of toleration as well.
Yeah, I think it definitely adds a critical piece to understanding the category of dissent. And, you know, if readers are going to do that, understand dissent, you can't miss the role of the Bible and this post-Reformation theological culture. That's kind of what you set out anyway in your chapter on the Bible and theology. Can you share some of your arguments here about the age of biblical scholarship and also biblical dispute here?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this chapter is having to cover quite a lot of ground, but it did try and provide a map, or at least a sketch of dissenting theological positions and attitudes towards the Bible, which is not an easy task because dissenters could actually be found all over the map theologically. So what I'm exploring, I suppose, in this chapter is the paradox that dissenters who were immersed in the Bible found Scripture to be both a common language and a textual battleground. So if you've ever, anybody who's read 17th century texts will realize they're bristling with biblical references, but also the phraseology of 17th century writers is often drenched in scriptural phrases. So this is a culture in which the Bible is sort of ubiquitous. You know, it's been estimated that before 1640, there are about 600,000 copies of the whole Bible printed in England and about another million copies of the New Testament and Psalms. So about 1.5 million copies of the scripture in a country with only 4 or 5 million people, where many of the population are illiterate. So, you know, emphasizes just how much English culture in this period is drenched in the Bible, the culture of the literate, but also it's an oral culture, so the Bible's read out loud, and so many people who can't read are still familiar with it. And the godly go to great lengths to disseminate the Bible. I mean, perhaps the most striking example is in Massachusetts, where the Congregational minister, John Eliot, together with a number of collaborators among Native Americans, produces an Algonquian translation of the Bible, the whole Bible, in the early 1660s, which is remarkable given that there wasn't a written language to begin with. You know, so this is a huge translation project, and dissenters are very involved in biblical scholarship and commentary as well. In terms of theology, most dissenters identified strongly with the Reformed tradition. You know, so in other words, a tradition that stemmed from Calvin and Zwingli and Butzer and other great 16th century reformers. The shorthand way of saying this, I suppose, is to say they were Calvinists, though scholars nowadays tend to prefer to talk of Reformed or Reformed Orthodoxy, which was not simply derived from Calvin, but is what a wider range of sources, and wasn't always obsessively focused on the doctrine of predestination, though English Protestants tend to be quite preoccupied by predestination, but it has a much wider range of interest theologically. And among dissenters, it's propagated really through confessions of faith as well as theological treatises. So the Westminster Confession of Faith, which Presbyterians and Congregationalists draw up initially for the national church in the 1640s, but then it becomes a key point of reference for Presbyterians in Scotland, but more widely in other areas where Presbyterians are found in later periods. And then you get the spin-offs from that, the adaptations of it, you know, the Savoy Confession of the Congregationalists, the Baptist Confessions. So most Presbyterians, Baptist Congregationalists would have identified with Calvinism or with Reformed Orthodoxy, but not all. So many dissenters were skeptical about subscription, required subscription to confessions of faith, particularly Richard Baxter, who really sees Christian unity in terms of unity around the Apostles' Creed, maybe the Nicene Creed, but not so much around modern confessions. And that will be very influential among 18th century dissenters, that view. But you also get many dissenters who are heterodox, you know, who embrace Arminianism, rejecting the Calvinist doctrine of predestination. And that's particularly true among some of the Baptists. You get antinomian groups who emphasize a Christian's freedom from the moral law. And even anti-Trinitarianism emerges among some radical dissenters from the 16, even in the early 17th century, but particularly from the 1650s. But I guess the most radical group are the Quakers, because the Quakers reject the two Protestant sacraments, you know, of the communion and baptism. But they also emphasize the inner light as opposed to the external authority of the scriptural text. And they reject confessions and ordained clergy. And they don't place the same emphasis on the atonement, on Christ's death on the cross, as other Reformed dissenters would have done. But I think it's also interesting that some of the theological disputes cut across denominational lines, and it's particularly striking that, you know, Anglicans aren't just conservatives. I mean, all kinds of quite radical theological ideas emerge among Episcopalians in the 17th century. Someone like Jeremy Taylor rejects Augustine's doctrine of original sin, for example. And you've got Anglicans in the later 17th century questioning traditional formulations around the Trinity. And people like John Locke and Isaac Newton are anti-Trinitarians, but they're also always members of the established church. And partly for that reason, they keep their anti-Trinitarianism very close to their chest.
That's really helpful, John. And, you know, for such a complex portrait of the post-Reformation era of dissent, this book helps tease out. It does leave the question that you pose right at the beginning in your introduction, which is, what is the legacy of 17th century Protestant dissent? What can you say of the texts and traditions that have survived after the lives of those that we've talked about here?
Mm. Yeah, that's a huge question. And of course, quite a lot of ink has been spilt about the legacy of 17th century Puritanism and 17th century dissent. I mean, not least in relation to Max Weber's thesis about Protestantism and capitalism, which was initially focused quite strongly on Puritanism, but he also wrote an essay on Puritan and Protestant sects as well. So I won't try and address the Weber thesis, which is probably a subject for a podcast in its own right. But there are clearly institutional legacies. So the fact that the survival of these four traditions, Presbyterianism, which of course in many ways emanates from Scotland. I mean, not there's English Presbyterianism, but there's also Scottish Presbyterianism, and it tends to be Scottish Presbyterianism and Scots-Irish Presbyterianism that's exported to the United States. But the Congregationalists and the Baptists and the Quakers are groups which really emerge with a quite a distinct identity in 17th century England, and they go on to have a very important history. I mean, they grow in importance in English history, but they're also, of course, exported to other parts of the world. So I think, you know, nowadays you probably have more Presbyterians in Korea than in Scotland, and more Baptists in Brazil than in Britain. So there's the institutional legacy of those denominations that persist. There are also, I guess, intellectual legacies. So various dissenting texts, confessions of faith, books like William Penn's No Cross, No Crown, the theological writings of Richard Baxter and John Owen, and most of all Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, go on to acquire a kind of classic status, and they're republished many times and widely read in the 18th and 19th centuries. Dissenters also do, although they're divided about religious toleration, radical dissenters like Baptists and Quakers are, and some Congregationalists, are quite important in really advancing ideas of liberty of conscience. Even by the early 18th century, the Presbyterians have come around to the idea that religion, that the individual has a right to choose their religion for themselves. So the Presbyterians by the early 18th century, having once defended religious uniformity, are now highly critical of it and are arguing for the individual conscience as kind of sacrosanct. And that is an important legacy, I think, to the 18th and 19th centuries. And more broadly, there are political legacies. So, you know, there is a certain affinity in England, certainly, between religious dissent and political dissent. Partly, I think, because of the outsider status of dissenters, that they have a sort of oppositional ethos and can look at the status quo in a more critical way. They tend to gravitate in the 18th century towards the Whig Party. In the 19th century, there's this very strong alliance between liberalism, political liberalism in England, and nonconformity. You know, Methodism is feeds into the Labour Party and so on. So the story of 17th century dissent has always attracted historians on the left in England. Things are a bit different in the United States, of course, but even in the American, if you think of the American Revolution, I mean, Anglican loyalists complain bitterly about Puritan New England and the Presbyterian middle colonies, and they see the American Revolution as being a sort of dissenting affair, though, of course, it's a bit different in Virginia with various low church Anglicans involved as well. But I do think there are political legacies, and you know, there's an interesting kind of counterfactual question about the, you know, what Anglophone politics would look like without, say, a group like the Quakers, who are very much a product of the English Revolution. I mean, they come from nowhere, really, in the late 1640s, and 10 years they've grown to about 50,000 people. But although they're always a small group compared to some other dissenters, they are one of the most consistently oppositional, and of course they make significant contributions to everything from anti-slavery and pacifism down to Amnesty International in the 1960s. So some of these developments in the middle of the 17th century in England do, I think, have long-term ramifications.
Well, I think that's really well said there, John, and it helps wrap up this really exciting chance to hear from you on the book and hear about good scholarship on the development of post-Reformation dissent. Before we wrap up, though, John, can you share with our listeners what writing projects you're working on now and what they might expect from you next?
Yeah, so my main project now is sort of taking me quite a long way from the mid-17th century. Because I'm working with, I'm leading a project with a number of other colleagues to produce a scholarly edition of the diaries of William Wilberforce, the Member of Parliament, who's best well known for his contribution to the abolitionist movement, the abolition of the slave trade. He left manuscript diaries. The surviving diaries contain about 1 million words. And only about 15% of this has ever been published in the past. So what we're doing is we've now transcribed it, and we're correcting the transcription, and we've actually just begun the sort of annotation process. And the idea is in a few years' time to publish it with Oxford University Press. So it'll be a kind of big scholarly edition. So that's sort of absorbing a lot of my time. And it's interesting because in some ways Wilberforce takes me quite a long way from dissent, because he's very much an establishment figure, an insider. You know, he's an Anglican. He's hobnobbing on a regular basis with MPs, with peers, with members of the political and social elite, with the aristocracy and the gentry. On the other hand, he has many contacts with dissenters as well. I mean, not least in Yorkshire. He's MP for Yorkshire, and Yorkshire is a great centre of dissent and political or religious dissent in the late 18th, early 19th century. And dissent is really growing and burgeoning in Wilberforce's lifetime. So groups like the Baptists and the Methodists and the Congregationalists are growing very fast. And he's got various connections with their missionary movements, but also with the Quakers around the slave trade and so on. So I'm not entirely leaving dissent behind, though I am now working on a famous Anglican, I suppose.
Well, it sounds like a great project. Thanks for sharing that. You know, for now, though, thank you for putting together this excellent volume. It's volume one of the Oxford History of Protestant Dissenting Traditions. It was published with OUP just in 2020. And John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about the book, Zach. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Absolutely. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network.